Right, as I've seen this slide, I've been really touched by you guys loving us as a family as we've gone through a really hard week with Claire being so very ill. And I want to say thank you. Just thinking to myself what it means to love one another. I know what it means to love one another because my church has taught me as you've sent texts and as you've visited and delivered meals and made posted cards and just shown support in lots of different ways. It means so much to me and to the kids and to Claire as well, so thank you. And that's my prayer really as we go through this series, that we would become that church where people come here and they're going through something like we are as a family at the moment, and we really feel loved. And that's amazing. It's so encouraging. So let's it's made itself right. Good. Let's think about what we're dealing with this morning. Conflict resolution. We must be skilled at conflict resolution here at Argyle. We absolutely must. It's really, really important. And the reason for that is that conflict is inevitable. It's a fallen world. We are, most of us, Christians, and so we've been made new, but we still have a residue of the fallen nature in us. And therefore, as Johnny mentioned when he was talking about the camp and introducing the subject, we will butt heads, and we will fall out, and we will annoy each other, and we will wind each other up, and we will clash, and there will be real conflict, not just us with non-Christians, but us together in the church. It will happen, it's inevitable, so we need to get good at conflict resolution. But also we need to get good at it because Jesus said in Matthew 5:9, blessed are the peacemakers. He did not say blessed are the conflict makers, the troublemakers. He said blessed are the peacemakers. That's what we're to be. And this is really important. If we don't get good at conflict, we run the risk of conflict ruining our relationships and our church even. There have been, I'm sure you know, many churches that have ended up splitting and dividing and all sorts because there's a conflict and it's not resolved and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It can ruin churches. And I'm sure you've experienced in your relationship, there's been an argument and it's not been resolved and it's just ballooned until there's been this huge fallout. And that can split families. And can ruin marriages and all sorts. So it's crucial that we get good at conflict resolution. Conflict resolution is hard. We're going to do this sermon by looking at how Paul resolved conflict between himself and Peter in Galatians 2. And he did that well, and we're going to look at that. But he didn't always do so well. He fell out with Barnabas over, I think it was Mark, wasn't it, in Acts 15. And Acts 15:39 says, they had such a sharp disagreement that they parted company. So even the Apostle Paul and even Barnabas struggle with conflict resolution. So we will. So if you've messed up in the past and you think, I just can't face it again, take heart. It is hard. We've all been there. Keep trying. Keep trying to resolve those conflicts that come up. This is such an important topic that we're going to be doing two sermons in the future on very similar subjects, confrontation on the 16th of June and peacemaking 18th of August, because it's so important that we get this right. I want to start off by testing your knowledge of some famous fallouts, okay? I'm going to give you one side of the couple that fell out and see if you can remember who the other is. So this is David Beckham. That picture, if you're into football, is very significant. Can anyone tell me who he fell out with? That picture was in the press kind of the next day.
Alex Ferguson for a football
boot. That's right. They called it Bootgate, I think, didn't they? Alex, I think it was after the Man United-Arsenal FA Cup match. I think Man U lost and there was an argument in the dressing room and he threw or kicked a boot at Beckham and it cut him above the eye and they had this big falling out. So I grew up listening to this guy, my parents' records. Who did he famously fall out with? Yeah, and it's really, I looked it up a little bit, right from when they were really young, almost still children. And I think their careers were taking off, and then Paul Simon chatted to this record producer, recorded a couple of songs without telling Art. And right from that beginning, they fell out over that. And although they did, you know, do records together and stuff, and albums together, it rumbled on throughout the whole of their career, this conflict between them that was never really fully resolved. Lady Gaga, who did she have a famous falling out with, another famous diva type person? Anyone know? Her big enemy? Apparently they've made up now. So the gossip magazines tell me, which I don't read at the dentist or the doctors. Anyone know? It was Madonna. Apparently Madonna accused Gaga of stealing her sound for Gaga's song Born This Way, and it all erupted and they became enemies, but maybe frenemies now. Thomas Edison. A huge historic falling out with someone whose name has got very famous now because of a certain entrepreneur. Anyone know? Tesla. Yeah. So he fell out with Nikola Tesla. Tesla was his protege, is that the word? So Edison mentored Tesla. And Tesla came up with all these really good inventions. Edison had promised to pay him loads of money. And at the end of the time together, he refused to pay. He said, I was just joking. I'm not going to pay you the money. So there's this big falling out. Tesla went his own way. And Tesla invented AC, alternating current electricity. And Edison had done DC. And Edison was so annoyed about this mentor of his starting his own company that he did these horrendous public demonstrations to discredit AC power, where he electrocuted dogs and cows and horses and even elephants. It was crazy. He went to those lengths because of the falling out. It was so big. Last one, Adi Dassler. Who did he have a big falling out with? A sportswear founder. You can see the clue in the stripes. Anyone know? No, he fell out with his brother Rudy. So they started the Dassler footwear company, and it was all going well. And they had this argument, and it's unclear. It's one of those arguments where you forget what you even argued about. But they fell out in such a big way that his brother Rudy went off and formed Puma, the sportswear company. Adi Dassler formed Adidas, and it split the family. And it actually split the town. There were two manufacturing plants in the town. You either worked for Puma or Adidas. And it was like a sort of Romeo and Juliet. You didn't dare marry into the opposing part of the family. And it carried on so much so that it was never resolved, and they were buried sort of opposite ends of the cemetery in the town. And that's why it's so important, isn't it? Because we can kind of chuckle and smile at these famous fallouts because they're nothing to do with us. But it's horrendous when you're involved in a fallout, isn't it? Or when you're in the court in the crossfire. And it's never resolved and people die without making up. And sometimes it can be so ridiculous and you can't remember what it actually was that you fell out over. And yet all you know is, I hate that person. So this is a really serious issue. I want to start off by thinking about how we respond to conflict. I'm drawing from a book called The Gospel-Centered Life by Thune and Walker. Now, think about the last conflict you had, the last argument you had, disagreement with someone. Okay? Put aside for a moment what you argued over. Don't need to think about the person particularly. Don't need to think about whether you were right or wrong or whatever. But think about how you approached the conflict, the sort of things you did and how you felt and what you said. According to Thune and Walker, we tend to fall into two sort of categories. We're either attackers or withdrawers, and that's how we sort of default into doing conflict. So if you're an attacker, the way you'll approach conflict is this. You'll deal with your anger by venting it. You're frustrated, and so you need to get it out. So you yell or shout or whatever, however you vent. You will really be passionate about your case, and you'll argue and argue and argue to get your case across. You'll ask questions like, how do you know? How can you prove that? Show me. You'll be that kind of person. You'll just carry on fighting. You're like a dog with a bone. You won't let it go. You fight till the fight is over, and you've won. You're like a lawyer. You cross-examine the person. You want to get to the heart of the issue. And you're like in one of those US dramas where the lawyer's really aggressive. For you, if you're an attacker, winning the conflict is much more important than loving your opponent. And you tend to turn the argument to focus on the other person, even if it began with you as the focal point. That's what you'll sort of try and do. You'll shift onto the other person. So that's like the way we sometimes approach conflict. We go into attack mode, or we're more withdrawers. And when you are involved in conflict, this is how you will behave. You'll deal with your anger by suppressing it. You do have opinions, but you don't want to vent them. You'll keep them to yourself for the sake of maintaining peace. You'll ask questions like, do we really have to do this now? Is it really necessary to talk about this? Can't we just let this go? Those are the sort of questions you'll ask. You'd much rather avoid a fight than win it. Winning isn't very important to you. And sometimes you find you have to physically just leave an argument, leave the room, because you need to get some space, because it's too much. Neither of these ways are particularly good ways of dealing with conflict. It will depend on your personality or your upbringing or maybe your culture. Maybe if you're from Australia or America or South America or Italy, you'll maybe be this. Maybe if you're British or Canadian or Japanese, you'll maybe be like this. It's a cultural thing often. But neither of them are particularly biblical. So what we're going to do is look at the biblical way of arguing. And here's the thing about attacking and withdrawing. It tends to reveal your heart. That's the scary thing about how we do conflict. It reveals what we're like inside. And if you're an attacker, that can reveal that you've got a heart of pride. That for you, looking good and being right is the ultimate thing. That's where you get your self-worth from. You detest losing face. That's just a no-no. You've got a heart of self-righteousness that always has to argue that you're right and righteous and show everyone. If you're a withdrawer, that can reveal that you've got a heart of fear, that what you hold high and what you worship and what you need is people's approval. So you'll go to great lengths to keep people's approval and not lose it. You've got a heart of insecurity that's clutching onto what people think of you rather than what God thinks of you. So this is really revealing. It can expose our hearts. But attacking or withdrawing, we could say violence or silence, whatever it is, passive or aggressive, they're not good ways of resolving conflict. We're going to now look at heart-healthy, biblical ways, drawing from Galatians chapter 2, but also other parts of the Bible as well. Six steps we're going to look at. Step one, pick your battles. So this is before you even begin the conflict. It's asking yourself, do I really need to do this? Is it really necessary to resolve this particular conflict? Is it important enough? Or should I just let it go? Sometimes the conflict absolutely must be resolved and you need to step up to the plate and get going. But sometimes the Bible advises let it go. And we see this in Proverbs 12 and 16. So fools show their annoyance at once, but the prudent overlook an insult. So there are times when it's prudent and wise to just pass over an insult or a slight. Proverbs 19:11, a person's wisdom yields patience. It is to one's glory to overlook an offence. It's very strongly worded, isn't it? It's a glorious thing to not get wound up and bothered about something offensive that's been said or done, just to be able to have a peace and a joy and let it pass over you, really, and not bother you. Not to be that spiky, pricky person who reacts to everything. So pick your battles, that's step one. Figure out if you should resolve this or not. That requires wisdom. So pray, maybe seek counsel, pick your battle. Step two, do some planking. Do you guys remember, I don't know whether it's in the 90s or 2000s, this trend came in called planking. Do you remember that? A really bizarre thing where people kind of went all stiff and just lay down in public like a plank. Well, it's not that type of planking, okay? It's planking that Jesus mentions in Luke 6. Let's say you've decided that you do need to resolve conflict, so you're going to go for it. Step two is all about getting ready for the confrontation, preparing yourself, and it's essential because this step means that you'll approach it with the right mindset and the right headspace. So Jesus talks about planks in Luke 6. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? So before we embark on conflict, what we've got to do is look at our own sins and our own failings and our own weaknesses and our own mess-ups and think about, well, we've offended people or misused our tongue and hurt people. We need to find our planks, ask the Spirit to reveal them to us, because that humbles us. And so we're going into the conflict with a humble heart and one that's not saying, I'm great and I'm going to tell this person, put them in their place, but one that's saying, I want to talk to you about this sin, but I'm very, very conscious of my own sin as well. So that gets things off on a right footing, us approaching the conflict humbly. Do some planking. Step three, don't gossip or bully. In Galatians 2, Paul confronts Peter. They're disagreed about an issue, and it needs resolving. It's super important. But Paul didn't resort to gossiping or bullying. He didn't kind of withdraw and then talk to everyone else about the issue and badmouth Peter behind his back. And nor did he attack Peter by bullying him or insulting him or mocking him in public, anything like that. Kind of backing him into a corner and then doing this big public put-down. He didn't do that. Instead, he went directly to him and spoke to him face-to-face. And we see that in Galatians 2, 11 and 14. So when Cephas, that's Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. So he spoke to him man-to-man, face-to-face. He didn't go behind his back and gossip. Gossip is for cowards. Gossip is for people who are too cowardly to have a chat face-to-face with the person they're talking to other people about. It's a cowardly act. If it really means that much to you, talk to the person. Don't just spread bad things about them around. And this is the best way to sort conflict, face-to-face, better than a phone call, way better than a text. Don't text to resolve conflicts. Certainly don't make cryptic or not-so-cryptic comments on social media about the issue or the person. Don't do that. Go face-to-face and talk to them. And then we read this. When I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas. So he didn't bully, he didn't yell or rant or threaten or belittle or insult. He said, he just chatted to him directly and calmly. That's how we should do conflict in the way Paul did. Step four, it's good to ask yourself as you're going into a confrontation and trying to resolve conflict, what's my motivation here? Why am I talking to this person about what I'm concerned about? What's my heart motivation? Is it to make myself look better? Is it because I'm really angry? I'm not even thinking straight. Is it to justify myself? Is it because I want to win the argument? Is it because I'm full of hatred and I want to injure that person verbally? What's my motivation here? Am I really concerned for the person, for their welfare? Am I concerned that the sin that they've committed may be harming them, dragging them away from Jesus? Am I more worried about church unity or personal victory? It's good to examine yourself before you go into conflict. And we see Paul's motivation in Galatians 2, 12 and 13. For before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles, because he was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. The other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy, so that by their hypocrisy, even Barnabas was led astray. So what's going on here is Peter used to eat with, and therefore associate with, and therefore be friends with, Gentiles. He was eating with them and saying, I welcome you, I accept you, I'm one with you in Christ. Remember his vision that he received, affirming that the gospel is now for Gentiles as well as Jews. Peter had received that huge vision, and he had stood up and said, it's for the Gentiles as well as the Jews. But now, under pressure from men from James, claiming that you had to be circumcised to be a Christian, he separates himself from the Gentiles. He doesn't eat with them, doesn't associate with them anymore. He only eats with Jews who've become Christians. That's what's going on here. That's the backdrop to this conflict. So with that in mind, discuss with the person nearest to you what you think Paul's motivation was in confronting Peter. And I think there are at least five or six big things that are motivating him to talk face-to-face directly with Peter here. Just do that for a couple of minutes. Let's continue. Hopefully you had a good discussion. So we're thinking about Paul's motivation. Yes, he confronted Peter face-to-face, publicly, but why? What was going on in his heart? What caused him to do that? Well, first of all, he was addressing the issue of works righteousness. That was what was motivating him. This is what was at stake here. Because these men had come from James, and they were saying, yes, to be a Christian, you need to have faith in Jesus, plus you need to be circumcised. It's what you believe plus what you do. It was about works, according to them. And then Peter was siding with them, so he was giving the message, oh yes, actually, you have to do this religious stuff as well as faith in Christ. So Paul is very concerned. No, it's not that. It's not faith in Jesus plus the things you do. It's solely faith in Jesus. That's what justifies us, what makes us right with God. So that's why he had this confrontation, because he was addressing this issue of works righteousness. He didn't want a leader in the church to be led astray or influence other people to start thinking they need to do X, Y, and Z to get right with God. Another issue was fear. Paul saw that Peter was afraid, and his fear was making him into a slave. And Paul didn't want that. Didn't want his fellow apostle to become a slave to fear. In later on in Galatians, chapter 5, verse 1, we read, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm, then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery." So he was a slave to fear. He was afraid of what those men from James thought of him. And he just capitulated to what they said. He wasn't acting according to his convictions and the gospel. He was just afraid. And his fear was driving him. Also, the issue of nationalism. I'm sure that motivated Paul. He didn't want there to be this divide in the early church where it was like, oh, Jews are more superior than all of the other nations, and you can only be a Christian if you become a Jew and do Jewish things. And he was also, I'm sure, concerned that that would segue into racism. Jews are more superior. You can only be a Christian if you are a superior person than everyone else. No, it was Jews and Gentiles. In heaven, it's every tongue, tribe, and nation. There was none of that. The gospel is anti-nationalism and racism. So that was motivating Paul. He didn't want that kind of message to be communicated by Peter siding with those men from James. Division as well. Very concerned to maintain unity. You think this is the fledgling church, it's just getting going. This could have ruined things. This could have rebuilt the wall that the gospel knocked down, the wall between Jews and Gentiles. This could have caused, you know, sides. Oh, I'm a Christian who's Gentile, and I'm better than you who are a Christian and used to be a Jew. No, he wanted the two to be one and to be equal, and not to have one think I'm superior than the other. And then this issue of leading astray. He knew that if Peter did this, it says he led even Barnabas astray. If Peter did this, people would follow him and they would be led into gospel error. So that was very strongly motivating him. So they're pure motives. They're motives that show that Paul was concerned not just to get one up on Peter. An apostle has more theological knowledge than you and I'm showboating. No, not at all. He was concerned for these issues, because they harmed Peter and they would harm young Christians and the young church. So that was step four. Ask yourself, when you're seeking to resolve a conflict with someone, what's my motivation here? Paul really cared for Peter. Do I really care for the person that I'm confronting about whatever issue it is? Let's look at step five. Prepare to sacrifice. So resolving conflict involves cost, commitment, and sacrifice. And we've got to be ready for that. I think it's a bit like restoring a classic car. If you have a classic car, You have to have commitment. You have to be prepared for a lot of cost, and you have to make sacrifices. You know, you have to have the smell of petrol or in the sort of cockpit, and you have to be prepared for it to break down, and not start in cold mornings and so on. But it's kind of like, if you're going to resolve conflict, there's going to be sacrifice involved. Think about Peter and Paul's conflict. How is it resolved? By sacrifice. By Peter sacrificing his pride and admitting that he was wrong. That's the only way it could be resolved, because he was wrong. He had made a big mistake. And we see this, I think, in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 5 and 6. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but shows favour to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Peter had to humble himself before God and before all the onlookers. And before the Gentile Christians that he'd let down, and you know, I used to eat with you and be friends with you, and now I'm not. He had to eat humble pie. And that's often the hardest sacrifice that we have to make in conflict resolution, to admit that we're wrong. We just don't want to. We don't want to lose face to the other person or publicly. But conflict resolution will always involve cost. If we're going to make things right, it's going to cost us. Here are some other costs that we might encounter as we seek to resolve conflict. I've talked about loss of face, really. We might have to be publicly humiliated. We might have to issue an apology. I remember a really moving incident in my old church. I used to be involved in this ministry, Tuesday Night Football, and it was run by the church. We had all sorts of people from Whitley come and play football. And there was this one guy who always used to foul people and often used to get into fights with people. And he was banned. He had a 3-week ban. And we were all really touched, because after he came back from his 3-week ban, he stood up at the end and said to everyone, "I want to apologise for my conduct on the pitch. I was out of order. I was wrong. And I deserve that ban." I mean, wow. What a massive loss of face. But he admitted it. And it totally made things right. And he was forgiven. And the game could be played without any conflict anymore. Forgiveness. We learned, didn't we, a few weeks ago, that it costs to forgive. And if we're the one who's been wronged against, then to resolve the conflict, probably we'll have to forgive. And that's tough. That's difficult. We have to pay a price to forgive. Awkwardness. If we're kind of in the withdrawer category and we just don't like conflict because it's too sort of awkward and embarrassing, and we avoid confrontation wherever we can, we're going to have to encounter uncomfortable, difficult conversations with people that we dread. We're going to have to. Delicacy. It's going to take diplomacy and wisdom and thinking about the right way to say things. And that's going to take a lot of thought and a lot of effort in resolving the conflict. There's an element of risk when we approach conflict resolution, because it might not go very well. It might go completely pear-shaped. There might be this massive argument. The person might be even more offended. It might. Hopefully it doesn't. But there's always that element of risk that's in the back of our mind. We might lose the relationship. Hopefully we won't. But that might be a cost. And we might say, "I'm not prepared to make that cost, so I'm going to avoid this." But that's not the right way to go about it. And then stress. That's a huge cost. Sleepless nights, going round and round in your head, worrying about it, getting anxious about it, thinking about it, not being able to stop thinking about it. That's a cost. But it's worth it, right? It's so worth it. I mean, imagine what Paul was thinking. How am I going to talk to Peter? What's the best approach? I'm the leader of this new church. I need to address this issue, but not cause a massive fallout. Must have caused him loads of stress. He talks about his daily concern, burden for the churches. But he did it because of the church, because of Jesus, because of the unity that we want, because we want to mirror the unity of the Trinity. Worth it. Last step, step 6, which is identify the issue and invite a response. And that's what Paul does in verse 13 and 14 of Galatians 2, this passage here. He identifies the issue at the heart of the conflict, why he had to confront Peter. And the issue is gospel hypocrisy. First of all, Peter was being a hypocrite, because he was the one who had proclaimed publicly in Acts 10:28, "You are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with or visit a Gentile, but God has shown me that I should not call anyone impure or unclean." He proclaimed that as a leader, and then ate with the Gentiles to back up his claim. But now he was backing off from the Gentiles. He was being a hypocrite because he said one thing and he was doing the opposite. But it was gospel hypocrisy as well, because it's behavior that's not in line with the truth of the gospel. In fact, Peter's behavior was totally against the grain of the gospel. One of my mentors preached a sermon on this called "The Day Peter Forgot the Gospel." Because he did, because this hypocrisy, this doing one thing and saying one thing and acting in another way, that's not how we behave in the gospel. Shunning one group of people and cozying up to another, that's not the gospel at all. So the issue is identified by Paul, gospel hypocrisy. But after he's identified this issue at the centre of the conflict, he invites a response, and it's this. He says, effectively, to Peter and the Galatians, who he's writing to, because it's interesting when you read his letter, he mentions this conflict, and then it just kind of carries on, and he applies it to all of the Galatian Christians. He says, please, drink this beautiful, pure water of gospel new creation. And that's the invitation, because of Galatians 6:15. At the end of his letter, he says, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything. What counts is the new creation. He's kind of saying to them, come back to where you started, the new creation. This is new, guys. It's Jews and Gentiles now. The gospel has broken down the wall between them. Drink that water. Don't go back to the way it was. Don't build the wall back up. That's what he's inviting Peter and the rest of the Christians and everyone embroiled in the crossfire to do. And the result? If they accept this invitation, wonderful result, healing, reconciliation, renewed joy in the gospel, freedom in the gospel, as well as, of course, restored relationship with Paul and with each other. So, there we have it. They are the six steps to conflict resolution, how Paul did it with Peter, if you like. But before we conclude, I just want to whiz through some helpful hints very briefly to help us practically do conflict the biblical way. Pray before you say. Take time to pray before the conflict, before you talk to the person. Remember James chapter 1 verse 5, we're promised wisdom. Claim that promise. Plead with God. Pray that he'd help before you open your mouth and speak to people. How to word it. Just going in with all guns blazing, saying, you sinned, and kind of just blurting everything out without thinking, that's not going to help things go well. Think about some phrases like this. These phrases came from a friend of mine. We were discussing how to resolve conflict, and these are some of the phrases he came up with, which I noted down. I found them in a book of mine, and sharing them with you. Say, I really want to seek a resolution here. Or, it seems to me this is the issue. How do you feel about that? So inviting the other person to speak, not just bleh, and dominating the conversation. Or, I may be wrong, but it came across to me in this way. Can you help me understand how you felt, or what the issue was, or whatever it is? For the sake of clarity, I need to be direct with you. So stating your intention before, so the person knows what's coming. Phrases like that just help conflict go that little bit more smoothly. And remember the power of gentleness. I found this when I was searching on the internet a year or so ago. I had a big conflict I needed to resolve, and I found this, and I just wrote it down and put it in my phone, and I read it through now, just before I'm going to go into the conflict. A calm tone of voice, a reassuring touch, or an interested and concerned facial expression can go a long way towards relaxing a tense exchange. And that's biblical, because remember Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Gentleness has power. That's how we do conflict. And then some questions to ask. I found these very helpful. ask yourself these questions and maybe ask the other person as well. It can help get to the heart of the issue. Because sometimes people blow up over something, but that's not the issue, is it? Something else is bothering them. And that's just a surface reaction of something that's going on deep down. So here's some questions we can ask. What needs are not being met here? What matters to you most in this situation? It's a good question to ask. What's really troubling you here? So rather than just reacting to what the person said to you or how they behaved, ask those questions to yourself and then try and ask them to the other person. Let's conclude. How do we get power to resolve conflict? Because it's hard, isn't it? And we need God's power to help us do it right and to help us succeed. How do we get skilled at it? Well, we draw from how God resolves conflict with us. That's how we get good at conflict. We all know, because of the gospel, our sin makes us enemies with God, doesn't it? We ignore him, we disrespect him, we rebel against him, we disobey him, and that brings us into conflict with him. We become enemies. But in the gospel, God moves towards us with the intention of reconciliation. So our six steps that we thought about mirror God's conflict resolution with us. Because that's what the gospel is, isn't it? It's renewing the relationship. It's been broken. It's reconciling. So we thought about pick your battles. God couldn't overlook our sin, could he? It's too serious. He's too holy. He's got pure justice. His holiness and justice just wouldn't allow him to overlook it. So what did he do? He sent Jesus. And we thought about Jesus saying, look at the plank in your own eye. Jesus didn't have any planks or any specks in his eyes or anything. And yet, despite having no sin, he went into conflict resolution humbly. He came from heaven to earth, pure and sinless, but was so humble. That's how he approached reconciliation. We thought about gossiping and bullying. Jesus didn't go around gossiping or bullying. Instead, he confronted sin directly, face to face, and still does today via the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit just comes to us and tells it like it is. That's how God is. He doesn't bully or gossip or beat around the bush. We thought about motivation. What was God's motivation? Loving restoration. That's what he wanted, wasn't it? Healing this broken relationship, freeing us from the tyranny of sin. All those loving motivations were what sent Jesus to earth. We thought about how conflict involves sacrifice. Jesus made the ultimate sacrifice to restore us from enemies into friends. The issue, the main issue at the heart of the conflict, sin and salvation. And the response, repentant faith. Jesus says, come to me in repentant faith. Repent, admit you're wrong, and trust in me that I died for you and took your punishment. So the gospel provides this pattern of conflict resolution. So when we're worrying, how can I resolve this conflict? We think, how did God deal with me? How did God sort things out with me? How am I now God's friend, not his enemy? How has he treated me? And we draw from that. And we're inspired by his treatment of us. So I want to finish by quoting again from Robert Thune and Will Walker, that book I referred to earlier when I was talking about attacking and withdrawing. The gospel calls us to repent of our sinful patterns of attacking and withdrawing. And the gospel empowers us to move into conflict by faith with a humble, confident, God-glorifying intentionality. Thank you.